from KQED.
Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. By 2100, the end of the century, rising seas could put at least 600,000 coastal Californians at risk of flooding and cause over $150 billion in property damage. That's according to a new study by the U.S. Geological Survey, which estimates that Bay Area residents will constitute two-thirds of those affected statewide. And in this segment, we're going to talk about the Bay Area communities that are particularly vulnerable to sea level rise and what can be done to mitigate its effects. And joining us here in studio is Molly Peterson, science reporter for KQED News. And welcome, Molly.
Thank you.
We're also going to be joined shortly by a geologist who is the author of this study. But Molly, let's sort of sort this out so people can understand what's going on here, because sea level rise for a long time was predicted on the basis of the ocean remaining calm and still and all of that. And now we've got this new USGS study, which is predicting changes in sea level rise, well, from other things, from storms, from tides, from erosion. Yeah.
Yeah. Patrick Barnard's team at U.S. Geological Survey has really been working to incorporate all of these effects in the model. Think about the bathtub. It's not just rising water in the bathtub. The sides of the bathtub are affected as well, and the height.
And this is really a pretty staggering number of statistics we have here. And the Bay Area looks especially vulnerable. We've got, in effect, you know, the Bay Area built on an estuary with millions of people just above sea level. And these are, unless mitigation is done pretty quickly and a lot of practical things are done, and we can talk about that, we're in serious trouble.
Well, and it's really complicated. Nine counties, more than 40 cities have some sort of authority and responsibility. There's like a rat king of authorities that are all having to deal with this at the same time.
I want to talk about that a little bit specifically with you, but what about these numbers, over $150 billion worth of property damage, infrastructure? I mean, these are almost apocalyptic numbers. Residents could be flooded to the tune of about 600,000, about two-thirds of property. I mean, it's just staggering. It's just staggering.
We're talking about like Katrina size effects, and that's the point of this study, is to call attention to that.
We're talking about something that would be bigger than the wildfires and the earthquakes, really, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's get Patrick Barnard in this. He's a research geologist with USGS and author of this new study on sea level rise. Pretty alarming stuff here, Patrick. Thank you for joining us here, and good morning to you.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, let's get right into it here. I mean, these predictions, we're talking about coastal communities, particularly grim and wet, and places like SFO coming underwater, Foster City. The list just goes on.
Yeah, what we try to do in this effort here is to bring together the best science to attack the problem and give the Bay Area and the coast of California the most comprehensive assessment of their vulnerability due to sea level rise and storms. And you look at the Bay Area, it accounts for two-thirds of all the projected impacts across California. And as you know, Molly noted, we're talking about nine counties on the order of, you know, 9 million people living close to sea level rise. And so the potential impacts of sea level rise and storms can be pretty significant.
Well, the science is changing faster than the cities can prepare or plan for this. What about city planning and preparation? What are you recommending?
Well, we recommend they follow the science. And the science is sound. There are a range of future possibilities. The big numbers that are highlighted in the study are the worst-case scenario, and that assumes we do nothing. That assumes we do not mitigate you know, greenhouse gas emissions to suppress temperature, which in turn suppresses sea level rise. So, you know, that's a worst-case scenario. So what we hope this can do to support communities to say, okay, this is the situation if we do nothing. We already have risk today that we are dealing with, and it's only going to get worse, so let's follow the science. This work that we've done here is really based on the work of hundreds of independent scientists across the world, atmospheric scientists, sea level rise scientists, climate scientists, you name it. And so we're building on this huge body of knowledge to hopefully develop what are you know, very, very good predictions for what could happen in the future if we do not act.
Yeah, you've got these scenarios down to meters, like a half meter to 2 meters, and what would happen in the event of 3 or 5 meters up. But there are certain things. Molly, let me go to you on this. Molly Peterson, again, a science reporter for KQED News. There's certainly a lot to be doing with seawalls and piers and this sort of thing, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, to say that the Bay Area is relatively active on sea level rise planning is accurate, but it's also really complex. We've already done a lot to either infill the bay or develop along the bay. There's levees and that sort of thing, but the quality of the engineering isn't incredibly well known because even just doing assessments like that on a very local basis is expensive.
And we're talking, are we not, Patrick? We lost Patrick. I'm sorry. We'll get him back here. But I was going to ask him about 4% of the GDP in terms of not necessarily even the worst case scenario.
Well, here's one example. So people in Hillsborough might think that they're not very affected by this sort of thing. But we've got wastewater treatment plants that could be impacted in a heavy storm as seas rise. So something that happens at low, you know, at a lower elevation closer to the rim of the bay might affect people up in the hills. Think about traffic along Highway 37 or in the East Bay.
So we could keep having what happened in 37 during the last rain over and over again. I mean, that's really what they're predicting, possibly.
And in fact, Patrick has told me that that he expects, you know, this isn't just this once at a time thing. This is something that happens more and more and more. And so 2100 is a number they use in the study. But really thinking about what mid-century planning looks like, where the confidence in the science is also greater, is important.
Well, we've got another new normal. Do we have Patrick back on the line? No? Okay. We're going to try to reconnect with the research geologist, Patrick. In the meantime, let me give out the number. I know many of you have questions about the sea level rise, if unmitigated, devastating the Bay Area by 2100. New report by USGS has put out the scenarios on this, and they're not very comforting, to put it mildly. You may want to weigh in here, and if you do, let me give you the toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now at that number, and we welcome your involvement in the program. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and I think we've got Patrick Barnard back. Patrick, are you there?
I'm back.
Okay, let's hope this line holds here. Let's hope also that the levees hold. That's really part of the problem, isn't it?
It is. I mean, one of the assumptions in this study is that all the structures will hold, all the current flood-controlled structures. We don't make an assessment of their own vulnerability. And we know, you know, from an example like Hurricane Katrina, that flood-controlled structures are not bulletproof. And so there's hundreds and hundreds of miles of levees throughout San Francisco Bay. Their structural integrity is somewhat unknown, and so that is certainly a factor that we have not considered directly in this study.
I was reading about, now it's a much smaller coastline, but I was reading about the Dutch with a national program that's been a model in many ways, or should be a model perhaps, for mitigation.
Yeah, you know, the Dutch take a very progressive view on this, and they have a legal mandate to defend against a 10,000-year flood. And so they are legally required to protect their communities for this most extreme of events in terms of building up their beaches, their dune systems, their levees. You know, conversely, in the United States, we typically look at the 100-year event as that sort of landmark event that we plan against, but we don't necessarily defend against it. So, you know, FEMA sets flood insurance rates based on that 100-year floodplain, but, you know, as a country, we don't have a legal mandate to defend against it, whereas the Dutch are legally mandated to defend and protect their communities against the 10,000-year event.
Molly Peterson, let me go back to you and kind of get, and then we'll go to our callers forthwith here, but there's an online mapping tool now that's available, and people may want to avail themselves of it. Talk about that. It's the different scenarios you brought into it, yeah.
Yeah, well, to sort of build on what Patrick was saying, too, this 100-year you know, event that we plan for in the United States, we don't even necessarily, the planning tools that that municipalities, that the federal government has relied on traditionally in the past, don't take into account everything that this study does. And so this study represents this kind of massive potential shift in thinking to think about all of the dynamic forces around the coast that could be affecting, you know, storm surges, sea level rise, water along the coast, not just a flood.
Well, we've been talking about SFO in this. Bill writes, for existing infrastructure, surely SFO's runways will need resurfacing sometime in the next 80 years. Add more height then and add fill to the land around them. Patrick Barnard, that may be more than Bill's suggesting along with SFO?
Well, there's certainly a lot of infrastructure at risk across the Bay Area. I mean, even today, you know, from an extreme event, we're talking about $8 to $9 billion, and SFO and Oakland airports are really
at the forefront of that vulnerability. So I can't advocate for a particular action, but the vulnerability is clear in many of these communities and many of these agencies, including those airports, are currently planning for sea level rise.
Well, we should also mention that, of course, all this is man-made, and perhaps there can be solutions that come from, well, men as well as women. Adam writes, there will be significantly more impact on our ability to grow food and maintain fresh water sources than on sea level rise. Climate change has the potential to kill millions, if not billions. Lost coastal property should be the least of our concerns. Either you want to comment on those sense of priority or hierarchy here? I mean, he's right. I don't know if the numbers are right, but climate change, you know, is apocalyptic as well. And should we be that concerned with property? Well,
the economic toll of destroyed property. I lived in New Orleans after Katrina for about 3 years. And to watch a community get up off its knees in that circumstance where their engineering that they believed in failed them. There was a federal government failures that created some of the problems there. That what that does to a community's ability to have excellent policing, schools, there's all these secondary and tertiary effects of something like that. I don't think you have to die to have everything massively affected by a terrible flood.
Here's Gary, who says sea level rise will restrict river outflow and cause saltwater intrusion farther inland. What could happen in the Delta and other rivers? You want to comment on that, Molly?
Well, there have been studies in the past. UC Berkeley engineers have led studies into the quality of the levees there and what communities are relying on. And whether that should affect, local zoning and planning is a huge, huge question and a very sensitive one. Because in California, we have so much authority that's in the local community. And developers and the pro-development lobby is so strong here in the state.
Talking with Molly Peterson of KQED News and Patrick Barnard of the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey. And let's hear from our listeners by phone. Martin joins us first. Martin, welcome.
Hey, thanks. Great program. Basic question, is this really a fatalistic situation where, based on the overshoot of climate, global warming, that we can't recover in 100 years, and so ultimately we need to be proactive and build levees and dams and more efficient ways to control water, the water rise? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the question. We'll go to you again, Molly Peterson.
Certainly here in the Bay Area, for the last several years, there's been this massive discussion about how to relate to the bay waters, whether we let the waters in, how we might have natural or soft edges to the bay in places that we haven't in the past. You can't do that in San Francisco on the Embarcadero, but maybe you can in other places.
And we'll go to more calls. And again, feel free to join the program at 866-733-6786. This is a Sausalito caller. Kip, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks. Okay, I've thought of this for a while. I've been thinking everything I can think of to help, and here's a simple solution. People are out on the highways driving 70, 80 miles an hour. Imagine how much gas they're burning. The more gas you burn, the more pollution you put out. If people would drive the actual speed limit of 55, it would cut down pollution enormously. Simple as that. And then with electric cars, maybe electric car lane, they can go 65. They're not putting out anything. Okay.
All right. We thank you for that, Kip. Go back to you on this, Patrick Barnard. Slowing down and all of that, have you figured this into your whole equations?
We haven't looked at that, but we know that, temperature is directly linked to sea level rise, and the whole point of the Paris Agreement was to stabilize temperatures about 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial. But we know in the recent geologic past, during the last interglacial, 1 to 2 degrees warmer equates to on the order of 20 to 30 feet of sea level rise eventually. That would take, many centuries, but I think it's within our own self-interest to keep temperatures as low as we can, thereby decreasing the potential for these really high rates of sea level rise in the future.
And Patrick, let me go to a tweet here and get your response from Christina. She writes, this was a great study, but the impacts will be much worse once we consider the effects of rising groundwater. The USGS has modeling coming on that, but it wasn't included in this study. Is she correct on that?
That's true. There are several efforts, one out of Berkeley and one that we're about to complete, which looks at the effect of sea level rise on the water table. And a lot of low-lying communities across California, while there may be protection against overland flooding, as sea level rises, there's potential that the water table itself could intercept the surface, and that could cause issues as well.
Anything you want to add here, Molly?
In particular, in the East Bay, there are concerns around industrial contamination, historic contamination that has seeped into the groundwater table that's now getting pushed upward by the potential for sea level rise.
So, and we're talking about a lot in the South Bay here as far as the Bay Area is concerned. Aren't we even more?
Yeah, there's also, I mean, think about where the waterfront is in the East Bay, where you had port and you had that industrial activity, shipbuilding activity.
And more of our callers will join us. Let's go next to you, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. My contention is that a lot of people talk about this in terms of future economic damage. My contention is that this is occurring right now. I've been a commercial real estate broker for 30 years, and it's a matter of marketing. Anytime people talk about a property of being undesirable, you get less demand for it. So I'm not criticizing people for talking about it. I am saying that residential property that is low-lying, industrial and commercial property that are in low-lying areas have lost value and are losing value today just because of the fact that it's an undesirable situation to have the seas rising up to a point where it might flood your property. Also, the infrastructure required, if you build at lower levels now, it demands that you build to a higher standard to resist future flooding. So there are millions of property owners in the Bay Area, and their property is devalued today because the demand is dropping slightly, but it's dropping for low-lying properties, I would contend, especially for residential properties. So that economic destruction has already taken place. It's taking place today. Now, if you play on that, if you emphasize that with property owners who are low-lying areas, you can increase their incentive to try to do something to correct the global warming and the rise of the water level that will affect the economic value of their own properties. So that can be used in a positive way to motivate millions of people to protect their own property.
Well, that would be the hope of this in part, Roger, and thank you for bringing that into focus. Here's Ron, who writes, where will the severe damage in the Bay Area be? Most severe damage, Molly Peterson, what do we know?
I mean, it depends on what kind of damage you're talking about. There's already concerns in San Francisco. I mean, economic damage, there's very strong concerns about the potential for how that would affect the waterfront and the Embarcadero. You see, to the earlier caller's point, you see real estate impacts in Foster City, and that's why there was an effort last year to tax themselves to sort of rebuild and rethink how that waterfront works, because there's concerns for those houses that look right out on the bay, right below the San Mateo Bridge, right over that kind of rock revetment in the front of Foster City.
And Foster City was always built on landfill to begin with. But here's Chris, who wants to know, isn't Treasure Island currently being developed for more housing? How is sea level rise being addressed for this project? Do we know?
That's a really complicated question, in part because there's so many authorities that have affected Treasure Island, but the Bay Conservation Development Commission has asked them to think about sea level rise in one of the more advanced ways in the Bay. At the same time, there's new information emerging, including from USGS, about how that land is subsiding.
And here is another caller. Maritza joins us from Oakland. Maritza, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you, Michael, for having me. I frequently do a commute to high tech, and I'm on traffic right now as we speak. And it's really dismaying that companies are not using the technology that exists to get more people off the road. I mean, at some point, if they don't self-regulate, I mean, I would imagine that there would have to be regulation to step in to get cars off the road. There's no reason that many of the jobs that people do can be a hybrid situation or can't be a hybrid situation where people are calling in and, you know, using all the technology that's out there. Too many cars on the road, and it's just not necessary in many cases.
Thank you for that, Maritza. Good to hear from you. Thank you for your call. This, Patrick Barnard, may not exactly be in your bailiwick. You are a research geologist. It's a political question, but I'd be curious to know what you have to say. Tweet from Charles that says, what can we do when the president, the Republican Party, pretends global warming is a hoax and prevents action at a federal level?
Well, I think it's really important as scientists that we be more outspoken about what we know are the facts. And I don't think this is a political thing at all. It's not that I believe in climate change. It's that I understand climate change. And it's important for us as scientists and for those in the general population that understand climate change to continue to repeat the same messages over and over and over again. This is a very robust science. It's based on the independent work of thousands of scientists across the world. We have information from the atmosphere, from the cryosphere, from the Earth, from the oceans. This is a huge body of evidence suggesting the trends that are occurring right now.
And I guess the real question is, what do you do against willful ignorance, really? Because you can repeat that message over and over and use the science, you know, demonstrably.
Well, I think it takes, there's a really great book called Merchants of Doubt, which goes through some of the major scientific and political issues of the last century, such as global warming, such as acid rain, such as smoking causing lung cancer. And what you find is that on the other side, the doubt that is instilled throughout these types of issues, it takes decades to overcome them. And it really takes a dedicated work, not just of scientists, but of people of all sorts to keep repeating the same message over and over and over again, that these are the facts, this is what we know, and eventually it sinks in. But it's very hard, I think, to cause change overnight.
Well, here's one suggestion. We talked about the Fed not stepping up enough. Leslie writes, why don't we hear states' rights as a pushback against EPA government deregulation of our environmental protections? And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Palo Alto. And Michael, we welcome you. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me on. I have a question about how this might relate to floodplain mapping. It's my understanding that the 100-year floodplain in the Bay Area and in many jurisdictions were recently remapped. And I assume that reflects kind of current mean sea level and 100-year flood risk. But is there any ability of the states to, like, kind of build in sea level rise into the requirements for zoning and building code that are associated with floodplains?
Yeah, what do you think, Patrick Barner?
Well, the state has largely supported this work and endorsed it to help communities in their climate adaptation plans. FEMA maps the 100-year floodplain based on current conditions, not future conditions. And so while our work, it does not have any regulatory authority, we hope it could be used as guidance, and the state is endorsing this work. And in fact, in their sea level rise guidance, they are looking out to as much as 10 feet of sea level rise as the worst-case scenario. So we try to do here is just provide, you know, wide range of possible futures to guide planning, but there are no legal teeth behind the maps that we produce. That's in a sort of in FEMA's corner, but they would require Congress to change their mission to directly look at the impacts of sea level rise and storms for their flood insurance.
Well, let me thank Michael for his call, and Patrick Barner, again, is research geologist with the USGS, author of a new study on sea level rise. And here's another caller from Los Gatos. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, Michael. Great show, and thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm really concerned about the proposed new seawall for the Embarcadero. Costs hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe more, over a billion possibly by the time it's done. But it will use a massive amount of carbons just to process the cement to burn the limestone and also the construction equipment, which is often out of phase with the environmental rules for carbon emissions. According to my brother, who was a carbon inspector for Northern California, he said the worst polluters of all in terms of the percentage that they're off specs was the construction industry. So the construction industry isn't going to save us because they're going to emit more carbons and cause more sea level rise than they abate. What they ought to use is a soft shoreline, like it was mentioned earlier, like planting kelp gardens and that sort of thing, to cause the take the energy out of the waves mitigation. And also grading the shore would help too, like an average swimming pool, you have a shallow end and a deep end. So that would also help the water go back into the ocean where it's supposed to be. And just giving galoshes to tourists, you know, an inch or two of water that might be on the sidewalk is a lot cheaper and more environmentally sound than the massive construction project.
All right, Tom, I thank you for that array of suggestions. And it goes back to a main point in my head, Molly Peterson, that is we got to do all we can to reduce the carbon footprint. That's really the highlight of this, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of trade-offs we're in the process of making, and those choices are being made locally at this very local level at cities. So even though the federal government's moving one direction, cities have a lot of power in California to move other directions.
And the state has done it. I mean, California's been in the vanguard, at least, but more needs to be done. I think it's safe to say. You want to weigh in here, Patrick Barnard?
Just there's a range of potential adaptation options. There's no one-size-fits-all. You know, there's everything from, you know, gray infrastructure in terms of building walls to green infrastructure like the massive tidal wetland restoration going on in the South Bay, and green levees. And there's just a whole sort of quiver of tools at our disposal to deal with this issue.
Well, it's important not only to bring in the findings that you've come up with in your study, Patrick, but how can listeners actually see the study?
Yeah, it's available online. It's an open access journal, so you can go and check it out. It's a Nature Scientific Reports. If you search on that and my name, Patrick Barnard, you'll find it. The other way to look at the results is at the website, ourcoastourfuture.org, which was developed by Point Blue Conservation Science, one of our partners. And that's the way you can interactively look at these different scenarios, zoom out on your community, and look at your potential risk.
And what would you say would be the priority for ordinary citizens here that they ought to know and really keep in mind to as much a degree as they can?
You know, I think looking at just the short-term risk, you know, we often look at climate change as the next generation's problem. But if you look at a significant storm in the Bay Area with even just 10 inches of sea level rise, there's lots of communities that have a risk at that level. So I think the immediacy of the risk is something people need to keep in mind, that this, it's in their own self-interest right now to work with their communities to begin to adapt to this potential problem.
The seconds left here, suggestion from you, Molly Peterson, along those lines?
I think everything Patrick's saying is the right suggestion. And these conversations are happening at city council meetings with every individual development.
Well, I thank you both. Molly Peterson, again, science reporter with KQED News. Good to have you with us. And Patrick Barnard, research geologist with USGS and author of a new study on sea level rise. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion. In fact, we encourage you to do that online. Go to kqed.org/forum. And we're going to continue our program with another hour. Professor Ellen Winter joins us. She's going to be talking on the science of how art works. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.